Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 1 for Autumn Semester 2015. Lecture 20, delivered on November 5, 2015. The title of this lecture is The Capital Asset Pricing Model.
Today, the Capital Asset Pricing Model. This is, to some extent, the pinnacle of the course, the big CAPM. Equation, you will see it, you will appreciate it, and at some point you will probably want to get a tattoo of it. There's a tattoo parlor here, it's the finance tattoo parlor. Don't go to the wrong one, because if you go to the wrong one, it might be the marketing tattoo parlor. Now, the finance tattoo parlor, they specialize in the capital asset pricing model. At the marketing tattoo parlor, they specialize in a tattoo that says, I can't find a job. And at the there's an accounting tattoo parlor just down the way, and they specialize in this one. I make a lot of money, but I'm bored as hell. But make sure you go to the right one and get your tattoo for the capital asset pricing model. Now, I'm going to motivate this. I can motivate this on a hellaciously theoretical level, but I'll avoid that, and I'm actually going to show you some practicality to it. Specifically, up to this point, when I wanted a discount rate for cash flows, for present values, net present values, all that kind of stuff, I've been quite honest with you, I've pulled them out of my butt. This is where you actually, the CAPM is how you actually get them, and it's not all that difficult to do. But there's a little bit in front of that, reminding you of the joy, the expected return to a portfolio. Now, I'm going to write the notation a little bit differently from the book. The book makes these big, big notations. And I notice that's kind of popular in textbooks these days. And you can actually compact it. The book writes the expected value of R sub P. You'll probably see me write that more like R sub P. But remember, it is an expectation. It's the expected value. It's what we want or expect to have, not what we want. Would be, in fancy notation, the sum from the first to the nth item in your portfolio of the weights of each one in the portfolio times the return to each one in the portfolio. I mean, just add up the weights times the respective returns. And there's your expected return to the whole portfolio. Nothing complicated about that. Now, the one that is a real pain in the derhi rear is the variance, as the book writes it, as the variance of the portfolio. I'm going to compact some notation here. The book uses SD of R sub I. You're always going to just see me write sigma sub I, the Greek letter symbol. That's what, I mean, isn't that what they used in your statistics courses, was the sigma to show a standard deviation? And variance would be R sub I would be, of course, sigma squared. Now, covariance of R sub I with R sub J. I'll just write that the same way if I have to have that. Now, covariance, you probably saw this in your stats course. Do you remember when they showed you these tables called analysis of variance, the ANOVA tables? They do that in the stats courses. Covariances are the ones that are off the center of the matrix in those. They are how two different items move against each other. Now, one that is in the book written as the correlation, core of the returns on one with the returns on another. More traditionally in, yeah, go ahead. Bigger, for God's sake, woman, why? Maybe, of course, that is way up there where the binoculars might help you a little bit. SD of R sub I. We write that as a sigma sub I. What was the other one? Variance of R sub I. That's just the square of the standard deviation. And I wrote the covariance thing of R sub I. I'll probably just write that the same way. But the one is the correlation coefficient that the book writes as the correlation, C-O-R-R, open parenthesis, R sub J, I, comma, R sub J. I want to point out there are actually several different correlation coefficients based on different ways of calculating. What they're using in this book and traditionally in finance, but not always, is what's called the Pearson correlation coefficient. But there are other ones. Traditionally, that is written as the Greek letter rho. Looks sort of like a round off P. The Greek letter rho of I, comma J. The Pearson correlation coefficient. I'm going to write something here to point out that finding the expected return to a portfolio, the expected return to a portfolio, and there's a bar over that I forgot to write, is an awful lot like work. In Excel or one of those financial programs, you can find these variances all the time. But here it is for just two stocks. If you've got a stock portfolio with just two stocks, if I remember how to do this right, you would have, it would be the weight of stock one, and this is two stocks, just two stocks. The weight of stock one times the, I'm almost tempted to do it another way, but I better not. R sub one minus R bar squared plus U sub 2 times R sub 2 minus R bar squared plus U1 times U2 times the correlation coefficient of I of stock 1 with stock 2 times the standard I'm getting myself even tangled up here. I always do that when I try to do this. Sigma 1 times sigma 2. That's just two stocks, the variance of a portfolio of just two stocks. Now imagine if you got 3, 20, a nice well-diversified portfolio of 50, 100 stocks. It gets to be a real pain in the assets, as it were. But there is a point. I want to show you something about this. And this applies much more generally. It would apply to all if I had, no matter how big the portfolio is. Notice something about this correlation coefficient goes between negative 1 and positive 1, typically between 1 and 0. The closer two stocks move together, the closer it is to 1. Essentially, the correlation coefficient is a scaled covariance. The less two stocks move together, the closer it is to zero. Notice that even in a two-stock portfolio, if you have these two stocks on their own, highly volatile, if they are highly uncorrelated, in other words, the rho, that a Greek symbol rho, is close to zero, then this portfolio has a lot of its volatility knocked out. At least this term of the volatility right here is knocked out. But if you get a portfolio with two stocks that move very closely together as far as their prices go, then that correlation coefficient would be closer to 1. So these two would tend to feed off each other. That's why you do want to build your portfolios to some extent anyway without a whole lot of correlations, especially if you're not going to have a very big portfolio. The one thing you can do to compensate for that in terms of reducing the risk is to make sure that you have stocks that don't track together very well through time. Hence, I'm going to show you something here. This is a website called Portfolio Visualizer. There are several sites that offer this service, and you can actually even download Excel spreadsheets to do this yourself. I caution you that several of these sites give wrong numbers. Their numbers are just wrong. They didn't look right when I was playing with them some time back when I first started using these sites. And I found this place called Portfolio Visualizer, where you can put in a whole pile of stock symbols, and it will show you the correlation coefficients among them. Now, here we go. Give me some stocks to put in. See how they're correlated with each other. There's price. What is? Well, what's the symbol on that? PFE? Okay. PFE. Give me another one. CAT. Give me a couple more. Huh? What's its trading symbol? Does Sony even have a trading symbol? Yeah, that's an ADR. Can't do it. Hang on here. Let me do this. Anything else? Sony would actually be an interesting one. So would, of course, Audi and all those companies that are involved in that scandal with VW. Something else? Where the hell did that come from? What is it?
CNX.
CNX, okay. CNX. What is?
BP.
And I'm going to just throw in a couple of my own just for something that's out there. Let me put in a retail store, Target, TGT. And let's put in Ford. Ford has a 1. Okay, and we're going to just let it run 60 trading days. Now, you have to be careful, of course, because the correlation coefficients shift through time. So you want to keep revising this, but let's have a look. And obviously this would be a symmetric, this is one of those symmetric matrices. A lot of places don't even put one side or the other of the diagonal. But okay, now remember what I said. You get down the 0.2, 0.1 range, you've got low correlation. But above 0.4, you're beginning to talk about more correlation. Now, if we look at this, notice that Ford against CAT, that's a pretty strong correlation. 0.43, that's more than I would prefer to have. But notice a Target against BP, very low correlation, which makes sense. Sometimes they make sense. Sometimes I can't figure out why in the hell two stocks have a high correlation coefficient. They have nothing to do with but Pfizer, notice that Pfizer is in its own world. It has very little connection to any, its correlation with the rest of these in the list is pretty darn low because it's in its own industry that is essentially separated from the others. So I'm glad you put that one in there. But if we are to look at one like, let's say, Caterpillar, now Caterpillar against CNX, now that's interesting. Now, what was CNX? Well, there is, you see that more often, and also against BP. Notice that large industrial companies and utilities tend to be correlated pretty strongly. The one that befuddles me is that Caterpillar has a nasty correlation with about everything. So if I were building a portfolio, one thing that I wouldn't even look at, if it's a small portfolio, obviously a large portfolio, you would want Caterpillar in there. But in a small portfolio, if I'm trying to get rid of some of that volatility of those standard deviations multiplying each other, CAT's not going to be a good idea because it seems to correlate with about everything. Now, that was Consol Energy against Pfizer, but it's against Target, not much, but against BP. Now, interestingly, it's not very much with Ford. And then, of course, BP, it correlates with a lot of things, but Target and Ford, it seems not to. And just working your way down the list, it allows you to begin to think about, well, why are these correlations here? Like I said, usually you can figure out good reasons. Sometimes it just, why are those two correlated? Or two that you think should be highly correlated, they're not at all. That's just, that's every bit as befuddling as the other way of doing, of having it. So there you are. There's the correlation coefficient kind of thing in practical terms. And showing you that formula there gives you the idea of what I talked about before, this effect that volatilities feed each other, but the correlation coefficient can mute that so that you're you have some diversification. Now, systematic versus unsystematic risk. You remember I've brought it up many times. There is risk that is in the system. You can't get rid of it. But there is risk that is beyond the system, it is embedded in the company itself or in an industry. That's why it's not always the greatest idea when you're going mutual funds for diversification. Well, I'm going to focus on a mutual fund in the energy sector or in the high technology sector. Maybe not a good idea because then you're getting correlations going on, and so you're not getting rid of as much of that unsystematic risk. Now, how does it play out in real life? The book shows you a very few examples. But you can have the unsystematic risk of a company in terms of the percent of the overall price volatility. It can be as much as 90% of the overall price. You should not be expecting a reward for that. You buy that stock, you got volatility, no one's going to pay you to bear. But there are other stocks, although even very large companies, they have stocks that are... Microsoft, I think, has about its volatility. Non-systematic risk. In other words, the risk that you could shake out is still around 40% of the total price volatility. So even a great big giant company still has a lot of risk that you should not expect to be rewarded for because you could get rid of it in a diversified portfolio. So, with that in mind, we move on to the next issue. A couple of things to start this out. Some terminology and some notation. And by the way, the CAPM is a very simple formula. It's understanding its power and its importance that is the something that would be worth you knowing about for essay questions on exams. Hint, hint, nudge, nudge. Here we go. The first thing that I'm going to do is... the expected return, and I can put this as a portfolio, as a security, as even a project. What is going to be my expected return, or what is going to be my discount rate on a project? What is the expected return for this stock, or this bond, or this ETF, or this mutual fund? So this could mean a lot of different things. Expected return to a stock, a portfolio, a project, an asset, whatever. Okay, now that's just the expected return to the security, portfolio, project, etc. Right there. The next thing that I'm going to bring up is R sub F. This is the risk free rate. And here's where I get a little more nuanced than I have before. This is a theoretical animal, but we can proxy it with something that we see. Now, up to this point in the course, do you recall that I said, well, we would use for the proxy for the risk-free rate the yield on a very short-term treasury bill? Because they're riskless. I mean, it's got to be darn close to this theoretical creature, the risk-free R sub F. However, in real practice, and I actually didn't know this until maybe about 5 years ago, because I had always taught this and I'd always used it in my practice. I'd go and find the annualized yield on a 3-month T-bill. And then I began to run into more and more places where I was seeing that that's not what they were using as the proxy for R sub F. It is common nowadays to use as the proxy a 10-year treasury note. And I finally, someone who does a lot more of the theoretical stuff, I said, what's the logic here? That has a maturity premium in it, doesn't it? And she explained it to me like this. She said, well, yeah, but she said, but the point here is that you are going to use the capital asset pricing model for projects, for securities, for bonds, for assets. She said, those are not short-term projects. Those are longer-term. And so if you want to match the numbers that go in with the numbers that you're going to use coming out, 3-month and annualized yield on a 3-month T-bill, it doesn't make sense. Use a 7-year or a 10-year. So being an old curmudgeon, I tried to stick with the annualized yield on a 3-month T-bill for a few years, but then I realized, yeah, it does work better when you use it like a 10-year instrument. There you go. Now the next one. R sub market. R sub MKT. Now the book puts an E of R sub. The book writes it E of R, the expected return to the market. This is the expected return to the market portfolio. Again, this would be a theoretical animal. It would be every stock, a portfolio that owned every stock in the economy, and the weight of each stock in the portfolio reflected the weight of that company's capitalization in the relative to the entire economy's capitalization. In other words, this represents what would a portfolio, what would be the return on a portfolio where you own everything in its proportion to the economy? And of course, you can't do that. I mean, we couldn't even, estimating it is sort of a pain in the butt. The closest a lot of people use in real practice, and you might actually use a CAPM in your life, or you'll certainly see it one way a few times. The closest in practice, like the S&P 500, remember that one? It's actually those 500 companies in number constitute a very small percent of the entire economy, by number. But by the weight of their market capitalization, if I'm remembering the number right, it's like 65% of the entire economy is captured in those 500 stocks. So you'll see a lot of, when you actually have to do this, you can't say theoretically, you actually have to put some numbers in there. And a lot of times you'll throw in the Standard Poor's 500. Now, when we are polled, I'm in a couple of groups, they ask practitioners and academics, what is your estimate of our expected return to the market portfolio? I do it with the Standard & Poor's 500 and then stack in 1,000 companies that are underneath that. So by the time I'm finished, I've got about 90% of the American economy in mind. And that's kind of scary, though, when you think about 500 companies have 65% of the economy, 1,500 control 90% of the frickin' economy. That's not a lot of companies. Hence, even the original economists were all highly conservative, libertarian, right-wing, whatever you want to call it. They would dirty their diapers when you got to the point of talking about oligopolies and monopolies. They said, no, that's not what we talk about with free markets at all. Okay. Now, one other thing that I'm going to give you here. R sub market minus R sub F. We have a name for this. It might be worth it for you to remember that name we have for this. This is called the market premium over risk-free. Now, you'll often hear me say the market premium. But I'm really shortening the market premium over risk-free. In other words, this is the reward you get for bearing risk instead of just investing in a riskless instrument. You got to change that. That's weird. It was in your pocket there. I thought, man, something's, you know, the hills are alive. The sound of music. Anyway, the thing there is, that, in other words, how much extra would you get for investing in the market portfolio instead of in just a risk-free instrument? Remember, the risk-free rate is merely the opportunity cost of foregone consumption. If you invest in anything above that, you are also taking risk for an expected return. This R sub market minus R sub F says, what do you expect to make taking a risk on the market? What do you expect to make taking a risk on the market? This is, again, we call it the market premium, or more completely, the market premium over risk-free. And, of course, it moves through time because both of its terms move through time. And finally, the beta of the security or the portfolio or the asset. The beta of it is, and I will just say this, it should be in your notes over and over again, this is the risk of the security relative to the market, the non-diversifiable risk relative to the market portfolio. The non-diversifiable risk of the investment relative to the market portfolio. It's interesting. This is, of course, a number that you can interpret as a percentage. Like a beta of 0.7 means that this stock has 70% of the volatility, the non-diversifiable volatility of the market portfolio. So, in other words, if I were looking for the expected return to a stock, and I were to plot that against beta, the first thing I would know that is that a beta of zero would buy me the risk-free rate. If I don't want any risk, then I'm going to get the risk-free rate. That's the y-intercept of all securities. So if I'm looking for a securities market line, I know that it would beta zero, expect a return R sub F. In simple algebra terms, this point right here is 0 for beta, R sub F for expected return, x, y coordinates and all that. Now, don't sweat too much on that, but I'm bringing up a point. I also know something else about this securities market line. I know something else about this securities market line. What I know is that a beta of 1 is by definition, the return to the market portfolio. That's what beta 1 means. It's 100% of the market portfolio. So in other words, I know a line up, a point up here on the line. One comma R sub MKT. And again, don't sweat too much. This is just sort of like more of a high school math explanation of what I'm about to do here, what I'm about to write. So I know that all securities should, not necessarily do, but should lie on this straight line. We call this line the securities market line. Now, I used to be, having taught, been a math teacher for many years, as well as a business economics teacher, teaching a lot of different things. Teaching math, I always, back in the day, I would use that, you remember those slope-intercept form of the linear equation and finding the equation from two points on it and all that kind of stuff? Well, I don't do that with you anymore. I just show you, if you were to do that equation, you remember, how is it? M times x2 minus x1 equals y1 minus y2 minus y1, whatever it is. Never mind. If I did that with those two points, 0 comma R sub F and 1 comma R sub MKT, I would come out with the famous capital asset pricing model. It's actually a very simple formula, and it's very easy to explain. That the expected return to any stock or portfolio, whatever you want to call it, is going to be R sub F, the risk-free rate, plus beta of the stock times the market premium, R sub MKT minus R sub F. That is the capital asset pricing model. It's that simple for finding the expected return to a security or a portfolio. And we can use this for all kinds of purposes to get those discount rates for net present values or whatever you want. Now, interestingly enough, there's an argument, well, why would you use this if you're looking for the discount rate for a project? Where would you get your beta for a project? What we do is, in those cases, we look for a company or a cluster of companies that do only that kind of project. And we take kind of like an average of their betas, and we say, well, that's about the beta of this project if this project were a company of its own. So we can even break this down and use this to get the discount rates for present values of cash flows. We can use this to get the expected values of different securities. Let me explain this. Look, the return you expect for any security or portfolio, whatever, at a minimum, you've got to get the risk-free rate. Why would you invest in a security if you couldn't get at least a T-bill? I'd go for the T-bill. So the R sub F is sort of like the bottom line. You've got to get that. Plus, there's going to be a market premium here. There's going to be a market premium out there. Beta simply scales your market premium. okay, you've got something, a beta of 1.5, you should expect 150% of the market premium. You're a coward, you want beta of 0.6, okay, you should expect only 60% of the market premium. And of course, adding on at the risk-free rate, which everyone should be able to get. That's the capital asset pricing model. Just plug the numbers in. Now, let me give you a couple of background insights on this, just to give this some actual meaning. I'm going to go with I didn't even write this down. I had the paper, but okay. The expected return to the market portfolio. I'm trying to remember my numbers. Okay. The last time I did it. The return to the market. What would be the number we'd put in to actually use this equation? I took just a huge number of stocks, and I looked at the capital gain. Remember, there are two components to what you make off a stock, two components to the yield. There's the capital gain yield, and do you remember what the other part was?
Dividend yield,
yeah. So in order to get this, I had to look at what the capital gain, the expected capital gain yield is expected to be. Last time I did this, I think the number, and I might be a little off here, it was about 12.5% cap, and this is the annual, 12.5% annual. Now, at that time, the dividend yield was about 2.30% over a huge number of stocks that I was doing. They were all big companies. I don't know if I did 1,500 or not, but I did a whole lot, the S&P 500 and a whole lot more. So putting those two together, I think this is my number. That's R sub MKT, well, not necessarily now, but it was a recent estimate of mine. Interestingly, the others who were polled to get the R sub MKT, we were all pretty much in the same ballpark. A few people were a little above 15, a few people were a little below 14.5, but everyone was around in this area, if I remember correctly. Okay, that's R sub MKT. So now, what would be the R sub F? The R sub F. Well, right now, if I don't remember. I think for a 10-year Treasury note, R sub F is running about. Well, heck, I could look it up real quick. Let me do it real quick, and I'm just showing you how we actually do this in real practice. Yield curve. Stock charts. Where's the 10-year right now? That looks at about 2.3. That's a little creepy. 2.30%. Just about exactly the. Where the hell did I just put my marker? Oh, there it is. Okay. That's kind of weird. R sub MKT R sub F right now, if you use a 10-year, would be about 2.30%. Okay? So, as a practical matter, right now, the market premium is 14.80% minus 2.30%. Which means that right now it is running at about 12.50%. In other words, that is the extra amount that you would earn for investing in the market portfolio instead of a risk-free instrument. That's your extra. That's your bonus. And then that is scaled by the actual beta of your investment. So in other words, if I bought a stock, if I had a portfolio that had an overall beta of, let's say, 2, the expected market premium in that case, well, let me do one. I don't know why I'm sitting on my fat ass today. Let's say that you've got a beta on your portfolio is 1.30. Let's just do one. Okay, so in other words, my expected return to this portfolio should be 2.30%, that's R sub F, plus 1.3, that's beta of the portfolio, times 14.80% minus 2.30%. That's R sub MKT minus R sub F. And so I can get my expected return to the portfolio that fast. And my calculator is not with me right now. Well, hell. Let me do it. Where's my calculator? Seriously, is it that hard to have a calculator where I can use it? Oh, well. Anyway, what would that be? What does it come out to be? 18.55. So that means you expect to make a little more than the market because you've taken a little more risk than the market. That's how it works. This is the CAPM. It's been around, oh God, it's almost 50 years now. And at first, we knew it was something important. As simple as it was, we knew very well it was something important. Interestingly enough, though, it took years for corporate to embrace it. And it took even longer for courts to embrace it. Because essentially there are types of companies called natural monopolies that are regulated by states and like electric companies. And the electric companies, the regulators determine a quote-unquote fair rate of return. Well, the regulators started moving toward the capital asset pricing model in the 1970s. But that was giving expected returns that the utilities were going to be allowed to make that were considerably lower than what the utilities wanted. So in court cases that came up in the 1970s, the courts were throwing out the CAPM, saying it was just a speculative, theoretical thing. It probably wasn't until the 80s or 90s before the courts finally understood this is right. Let me point out something here. I gotta make a note about something here. I'm going to draw the securities market line again. Draw it nice and big here so everyone can see it. Beta against expected return to the portfolio. Here's the beta of 1.0, and that'll return you the market. And this, at a beta of 0, you will get the risk-free rate. Okay, there's the securities market line. Think, in math, it's actually in engineering, in physics, in math, it pervades everything from engine performance to human athletics. It is in chemistry. It is all over the place. It's a concept we use the term envelope. An envelope is a boundary beyond which something can't happen. There's you might pushing the envelope. That would be like pushing an envelope up. But the thing is that an envelope represents the best efficiency that can occur on something. Like, for example, I can tell that you work out. Do you even lift? Okay. But you decide that you're finally going to become your very best. You exercise every day. You eat properly. You take lots of vitamins and minerals, and you come to the point where you have bulked up. But then there's a point where you can't bulk anymore. There's a muscle mass beyond which you cannot go. There's one for you, too. You are a big fan of race cars. So you have designed an engine. You've tweaked it. You've modified it. You've done everything possible. But there is a point beyond which that car cannot, a speed beyond which that car cannot go. That is on the performance envelope. It just won't go beyond that speed. Not with existing technology. Now, if you change the technology, the envelope can move outward. And interestingly enough, in some cases, envelopes can move inward. We've seen that happen with technological ability of civilizations. After the Roman Empire fell, or it came apart with in the 5th century, we saw the technological envelope of Europe and England just collapse inward. Things that they could have done before, they could no longer do. So performance envelopes can go in and out. That having been said, the securities market line is a performance envelope. In other words, stocks should not get above. If you think about this, look, suppose that you've got a stock with a beta of 0.8. And it's performing above its expected return. Now, you found that there is a stock at low risk that is giving returns that it shouldn't give. What would you do in a case like that? What would you do? You found a stock that has low risk and it has ridiculously high return. I would buy the hell out of that stock. And I would keep buying that mofo. And what happens if an incredibly large number of sophisticated investors who do this every day, their whole lives, with computers that are awesome, even their cell phones are supercomputers, as they buy in, what's that going to do to the price? As they buy, it's going to drive the price upward. And when price goes up, yield goes down. Well, spank me, Mohammed. That's the discipline. That is the discipline of the line. The market disciplines the stocks. If a stock is low risk and it's performing well, investors are going to flow toward it, drive its price up, drive its yield back down. But suppose that you also had a stock that was very high risk and it just its return just sucked.com. What are you going to do if you've got a stock that has high risk and the stock doesn't perform? You're going to sell that stock. And as you sell a stock, everyone's selling the stock. What does that do to the price? The price goes down. And when the price goes down, the yield goes, spank me Buddha. So look at that. There's a discipline to the market, an efficiency. Now, there are different levels at which we can talk about efficiency. But there is certainly an efficiency with respect to overall understanding of risk. If you've got an investment that is, if you found a stock that has a beta of 0.8 and the thing is giving almost virtually the market return, I'm going to buy that mofo all day long. And everyone else is going to figure it out too very quickly, and they're all going to go in and buy that stock. That's one of the nasty things, by the way, about the stock market, is this herding mentality. There are these services that most people watch, investors. Who's buying what? Who's selling what? So that if I can even get these screens, I can say, oh, these are big dogs buying this. I'm going to buy two. And every other person who watches these screens is going to see that. And they're going to run toward these stocks. And of course, that magnifies the price upward movement, which pushes the yield down. As every new marginal investor comes in, he's buying, or he or she is buying at a higher price and therefore getting a lower yield. That is, again, that market discipline, and that's why the line stays pretty much straight. Now, there are anomalies on the securities market line. Some of them are not really as much anomalies as they are just conspiracy theorists who don't want to learn math, so they have to condemn everything they see. But there are some that we do know kind of questionable. There's something called the small cap phenomenon. We do see a persistent number, cluster of small companies. Now, they're generally higher risk, that float above the market, the securities market line. It's called the small cap anomaly. How significant is it? Well, of course, the securities equivalent of conspiracy theorists. Well, this proves the market, the academics are wrong. No, it doesn't, you dumbass. Here's one of the things that might be an explanation. Look, when you get into smaller companies, most smaller companies are not public companies, so we don't have data on as many tiny companies as we do on large companies. So what we might be seeing is a biasing effect on just the companies that are small that are publicly traded, because we can't collect data on private companies. So whatever, and even if we try to, guessing what their stock price would be if they were publicly traded, well, that would be a really difficult thing to do. It's possible that what we're seeing is in those small cap stocks a bias. You know, you'll see companies that are floating around on both sides of the securities market line. They tend to ebb and flow, moving back and forth, but you can definitely see that clustering effect very nicely. That's one anomaly. I do caution, you'll see it. Don't buy the thing that it's the end of the capital asset pricing model. It's not. Another one that's kind of odd, too, it's called the January effect. For some reason, some stocks, identifiable, generally somewhat smaller stocks, their returns tend to be above the securities market line in the month of January. And it's a persistent phenomenon, and I've looked at the data and I'm trying to find what's wrong here. Can't really find it. It's an anomaly. It's called the January effect. And for a while, some companies, it's not a huge number of companies, it's a handful of companies, tend to float. Their annualized returns tend to float above the securities market line. In other words, their annualized return for about a month is a little better than the beta says it should be. It doesn't stay, and it goes away. And the question is, why does this keep staying? If we all know that it's going to happen, why doesn't everyone buy in on these stocks in December, drive their price up, and push their yields down? That's logic. But for some reason, it still kind of hangs around. It's very thin. It's not something really big, and it's not something you can make a fortune from, but it's out there. There are a few other little anomalies here and there. But for the most part, the capital asset pricing model is still rock solid. Now, there are criticisms, and I'll tell you a few criticisms of it. One criticism is that CAPM assumes that these two points here that we know have to exist are connected by a straight line. In other words, the CAPM assumes a linear relationship between risk and return. There are some academics who have made their careers writing publishing papers instead of teaching, like they should, who have estimated quadratics and cubics and things like that. It could be some. You know, this goes to something called Occam's razor. If you have models that compete with each other and they're equally valid, choose the one that has the simplest assumptions to it. And assuming a linear relationship is the simplest. And until someone can show us that the relationship is not valid, well, then one paper I did see one paper that kind of was fascinating. The guy said, yeah, if you look at, like, for example, a very large wide parabola, it really looks like a straight line for a very, very long time until it begins to make its turn, and then it reveals itself. He said, what if the capital asset pricing model is actually not linear? It's quadratic. But over normal range of betas from 0 up to like 1.5, 2.0, it looks linear, but it's only up here that you begin to get the hint that it is a parabola, that it is turning upward. Now, that's kind of an interesting idea. I don't know. I'm not going to use it myself. I'm still going to stick with the cap M. And there are some other arguments, too, to get into some real heavy-duty theoretics that are not worth it. Let me show you something here, however. Okay, remember I told you that the beta of your portfolio is going to be the sum from I equals 1 to N of the weights of each component of the portfolio times the beta of that component of the portfolio. In other words, it's the weighted average of the betas. That's the portfolio beta. Now, if you have any sense at all, you're going to aim at a beta in your portfolio. You being a very, very conservative man, you're a 0.4 beta kind of guy. Okay, a 0.5 beta kind of guy. You are insane. You are a 1.5 beta lady, okay? As a matter of fact, that's your vanity license plate. Beta equals 1.5. Everyone backs off you on the road. I mean, they know what that means. Yep, there's a risk taker. Okay. So what does that mean? How can we shape, instead of just grabbing stocks and hoping for a beta that looks right, is there a way to shape your beta? Okay. Okay, so now let's shape that beta. And there are several of these. Yahoo's got a fairly nice one, although you can get more comprehensive ones. Now, there's a caution. I won't tell you what it is here. But let's say that we wanted to hit dead on target a beta of 0.5. So the minimum we want to show are stocks with a beta of 0.5, and the maximum is a beta of 0.5. And let's see what we get. And you can do other parameters here, too. This is actually kind of a nice one, although it is kind of limited. It's very limited in what it shows you compared to the opportunities out there. But it's worth a look at. Well, looky there. A nice little cluster of beta 0.5. Like I said, there's not nearly enough there to, I'd want to really look at those correlation coefficients. That's a very small portfolio, but it's a start. But there's something odd in there that's a little bit troublesome. But you might notice there's a problem with that beta. Did they calculate it wrong? No, they didn't. But now let's look at the insane woman over there. A beta of 1.5. By the way, is your name Tiffany? I knew a Tiffany that was crazy like that. She was more of a beta of 3. Okay. Not a whole lot up there. Let's go back here. Let's see if we can find a beta of 2. Let's go with betas between 1.5 and 2. Well, there's a nice cluster of companies in now here, you're in nosebleed territory. You've got to have guts. And you also have to have a lot of money that you can give up. Because remember, the greater the risk, the greater the expected return, but also the greater the risk, the greater the chance that you're going to be dead meat in a grave. So you can see some here, kind of cool. Oh, wait a minute, what the hell? A negative. And there's a negative there. Did they calculate it wrong? No, they didn't. These betas are the betas of stocks that are contrarian. As a matter of fact, you can even buy mutual funds that are built on negative beta stocks. They go in the opposite direction of the market. They literally have negative correlation with the market. These portfolios and mutual funds, there's one I know, it's called the contrarian fund. It's just betas that are negative. Now, what stocks have negative betas? Well, that goes back to that saying I told you, from stocks to bonds, from bonds to gold, from gold to bullets. Stocks in gold mining companies are very likely to have negative betas. Because when times are good, gold is not very popular. When times are bad, gold becomes popular. That's why these shysters and hucksters and scam artists constantly trying to sell you gold, what they do is try to tell you that the end of the world is about to happen. The zombie apocalypse is happening. So the point, though, is that in good times, gold mining stocks will tend to do badly. And think of this, but in bad times, gold will become more popular. Not terribly popular, but there's enough of people who are suckered into buying gold in a bad time. Yeah, everything's going to go to hell, so you got to have gold because gold's going to matter and nothing else. Well, why will gold matter? Well, it's not fiat money. Well, it doesn't matter. Anything is money as long as people accept it as money. Gold, a dollar bill, toilet paper, moose, whatever. Anyway, look at these. Resource companies tend to have, and more generally, resource companies tend to have negative betas. Let me look here. Accusphere, I don't even know what the hell these are. Let me get out of this world of bizarre stocks, and let me go down, and let's get some stocks that are between 0.5 and 1. Find stocks. Okay, here we go. Find a couple of negatives. Tronix. Gold, there we go. See one? Negative beta. Canifacturing. What the hell is that? That's kind of... I wonder if they make... if they're the ones who can spam. Okay, let me spread it out a little more here to 1.5. Find stocks. Lab. What the hell are they doing in that lab that goes against the market? That should creep you. There's a lab. What do they figure out? Zombie vaccines? Resources, negative. Going back, a lot of negative, more negative betas will be between zero. They're not strongly negative. In other words, they're not that bad, but they are negative. But you'll see, look at all these safe stocks. Look at safe stocks. Bank stocks tend to have low betas. You'll see these bank stocks? Look at this one. This one's almost like the risk-free rate. Look at that thing. The beta is 0.08. That's basically a T-bill. Yeah.
So one of those stocks up on like 2 screens ago that had like a negative beta of 1.9.
There was one.
Well,
that's because the economy is doing pretty well, Ace. I mean, you've got a stock that is ready for the zombie apocalypse, and the zombies are down there partying in Vegas. That stock would suck in a time like this. And I will bet you my bottom dollar that the people investing in that, yeah, any minute now, they're going to come. Hell's going to break loose. And nothing happens. And the trading closes for the day. Well, shit, we're still poor. Yeah, you get the idea, though. Yeah, it's the contrarian funds are risky in a way. I mean, you've got to be a hardcore believer that Jesus is about to come. Because, I mean, normally you don't have to be terribly optimistic. I'm not an optimistic person. I'm the kind of guy, my cats like me only if I hang a pork chop around my neck. So the thing of it is that But you don't have to be too much of an optimist to grasp that this is a very good time. And when times get bad, how bad do they get? What? They got so bad that you couldn't that a middle class couple couldn't remodel their bedroom last year? You know, let's get real. And all the people who do suffer, do they really matter to anyone? Hell no. So, that's all I have for you today. I thank you.